From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. At the United States Supreme Court today, a victory for college athletes who had sued the NCAA in a long-standing quest to get compensated for their talents. The court ruled that the NCAA cannot ban some modest payments to student athletes, but the unanimous decision was narrow, and it did not decide the broader question of paying athletes a salary. It could still have a major impact on the multi-billion dollar business of college sports. So let's bring in NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. She is on Skype. Carrie, welcome.
Happy to be here.
And the court ruled that some payments to student athletes should be allowed. What kind of compensation are we talking about here?
This is a narrow slice of non-cash payments. Items related to education, things like laptops and other computers, musical instruments, postgraduate internships, and also things like vocational school scholarships after some of these student athletes graduate from college or university.
Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the unanimous opinion. What's the court's reasoning?
Justice Gorsuch pointed out this case sits at the intersection of the complex relationship between colleges, sports, and money. College sports, of course, is a massive business. $1.1 billion for television broadcast rights to March Madness, the basketball tournament every year. And the court has been wary of blurring the line between college sports and professional sports. But Justice Gorsuch pointed out the NCAA is not immune from antitrust laws. And he said it seems to have violated the Sherman Antitrust Act when it tried to limit these kinds of educational-related compensation payments to student athletes.
Well, the NCAA here will obviously disagree. Just remind us what their arguments were against allowing these kinds of payments.
The NCAA was very protective of its definition of what it called amateur sports and wanted to protect the market, the unique market for college athletics, and not have it turn into or morph into the same thing as professional sports. The NCAA also argued that there were other ways to achieve these kinds of goals without allowing these educational payments. But in the end, as you pointed out, the Supreme Court unanimously disagreed there.
Well, Gorsuch acknowledged potential criticism over this ruling because it is limited. Advocates are already saying, though, that it could have a pretty big impact on college sports. What are you hearing about what those broader implications could be, even though this is a narrow ruling?
Well, you know, one justice would have gone even further. Brett Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion to say the NCAA is not above the law and basically that any other industry would not be able to get away with this kind of anti-competitive behavior. Former athletes are saying this court decision today is a good thing, but it, of course, does not bear on this ongoing debate over the use of athlete names and images and likenesses. That idea is under consideration by Congress, and about a dozen state legislatures have already acted on that issue of trying to achieve some compensation for players whose images are used for promotional reasons. But those payments, of course, wouldn't come from colleges and universities. They'd come from athletic companies and others, of course.
And what kind of reaction are you hearing to today's decision from different points of view?
You know, the NCAA is just out with a statement. It points out that the Supreme Court allows the governing body to adopt reasonable rules and that the NCAA can decide what are and are not truly educational benefits, which was the heart of this case. NCAA President Mark Emmert also says that they're going to be working with Congress to chart a path forward, which is a point the Supreme Court expressly stated in its ruling, especially on this issue of name, image, and likeness use for student athletes. Of course, these athletes, their wages are depressed at a time when Justice Gorsuch pointed out that Mark Emmert earns something like $4 million a year to run the NCAA. And many college coaches at the football and basketball level can easily earn over $1 million a year in salaries. But the student athletes, of course, don't earn anything like that. They have very modest scholarships and some bonuses on top of that.
Carrie Johnson, what does it say to you that this ruling from the Supreme Court, as we've said, was unanimous? Every justice got behind the decision, whether they're conservative or liberal.
This is a really hard line drawing exercise for the court. A number of the justices are huge sports fans, Justice Kagan, Brett Kavanaugh, and others. And they did not want to blow up what college sports has meant to so many people and what has become, what it has come to mean and symbolize. At the same time, there's some kind of fundamental unfairness to student athletes not profiting off of their labor, which earns many, many other people millions and billions of dollars annually. And the justices drew a line rather narrowly here. We're going to have to see whether other challenges, legal challenges, get to the high court and whether they're as comfortable and unanimous in drawing those kinds of lines moving forward.
NPR's Carrie Johnson, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Over the last 5 months, hundreds of people have faced charges in the January 6th insurrection. And last week, the Justice Department released, at the request of media outlets like NPR, several videos showing a chaotic scene of people assaulting police officers and other mayhem on that day. These newly released videos are now part of the evidence prosecutors will use in court. And for the latest on those cases, we have with us Philip Bump, a correspondent with The Washington Post. Hi, Philip.
Thank you.
Now, this video released last week, it appears to show a former NYPD officer hitting a police officer with a flagpole. What can you tell us about the man in this case?
Well, like so many of the defendants from the January 6th riot at the Capitol, we know sort of in broad strokes how he came to be there and what he actually did once he was there. I think this case stands out. Both because there is such, there's this direct documentation of his violent approach to the law enforcement that was there to defend the Capitol, and of course his background. We've seen any number of folks who have backgrounds in law enforcement and the military who've been sort of rolled up as part of this investigation to what happened there. But I think he really stands out as being someone who both has that background, which I think obviously is notable for fairly obvious reasons, but also because he has this very direct and documented example of his lashing out against law enforcement in a way that we haven't seen from a lot of the other defendants who, may have been arrested for merely trespassing or things along those lines.
More than 500 criminal cases against alleged rioters are now underway. And until now, the media hasn't had access to that video shown in court. Why has it taken so long?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. There's a great deal of video that exists out there, and there have actually been a lot of calls to release more video in the hopes that either more defendants can be identified or that there can be something exculpatory that can be found in them. But, part of this is that the government has been both very deliberate in how it approaches these cases, but it's also there are also signs that the government is somewhat overwhelmed. I mean, it is not the case usually that there are more than 500 arrests that stem from one violent incident, particularly ones that require the sort of documentation and background to identify that people are in there. There are subpoenas to technology companies to figure out GPS pings within the Capitol, things along those lines. All this takes time. And when you have a scale of literally hundreds of these sorts of investigations, that seems to be leading to a backlog. So, we have seen over time these sorts of videos trickle out. If you have, for example, several hundred law enforcement officers wearing body cameras, it's going to take a time to go through all that video as well.
Yep. 21 House Republicans voted not to award the Congressional Medal of Honor to officers who responded on January 6th. They said they took issue with the use of the word insurrection to describe the events of that day. You've been writing about this. How have Republicans changed their rhetoric in the months since this Capitol riot?
It's sort of fascinating to watch the evolution. There's this very prescient tweet from a guy, David Graham, who writes for The Atlantic, and who on the night of January 6th said, remember what we saw today, because very soon people are going to probably try and reframe what actually occurred. And it was very prescient, because what we've seen over the months since is an attempt repeatedly to try and downplay what actually occurred. We've seen these attempts to sort of dismiss it as, oh, these are just tourists who wandered into the Capitol, who have said, they didn't have guns, so therefore this wasn't an armed insurrection, who have suggested that the amount of violence was overblown, that most of the people there, they sort of conflate the rally at the White House with the attack on the Capitol and say, there were these thousands of people there who weren't being violent. There are all these efforts to try and diminish it. And one of them is, to your point, this effort to try and dismiss it as an insurrection, which obviously is a term that has very loaded meaning. I think it is pretty obviously applicable to what happened on January 6th. But by trying to say it's not an insurrection by using, some sort of semantic argument, you're also trying to say this wasn't a very big deal, which has sort of been the theme of the Republican an approach from a lot of Republicans over the past several months.
You know, as we move through these court cases, it's part of the reason why these new pieces of video will be so important in challenging that argument.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is a very obvious example of an act of violence. It's impossible to see this as something other than a man engaging in an act of violence against law enforcement. Now, this is by no means the first such piece of evidence. We've seen these horrifying videos of policemen being crushed indoors, of policemen being dragged down the steps of the Capitol, the attack inside the Capitol itself. I mean, there are all of these pieces of evidence we already have. I think that what we're seeing, that as there is this pouring over of the available evidence by law enforcement, we may continue to see such pieces of evidence emerge, and as such to have reinforced the reality that this was a violent act on the part of hundreds of people.
That's Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.
After the murder of George Floyd last year, Dax Devlin Ross wrote a letter to his white male friends, the same people who were reaching out to him to see if he, a black man, was doing all right. At the time, protests against systemic racism and police brutality were erupting across the country, and Ross wanted his white friends to know how they could be better allies in the fight for racial justice. His letter ended up circulating far and wide, and now the idea has grown into a new book. It's called Letters to My White Male Friends. Dax Devlin Ross joins us now. Welcome. It's really good to speak with you.
Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you for having me on the show today.
Absolutely. So why don't you start with that letter that you wrote in the wake of George Floyd's murder to your white male friends of a certain age? What did you want them to know?
You know, I just felt inundated with concern for me, and I appreciated it from my friends. I really did. At the same time, I was a bit baffled. I mean, I think a lot of folks of color have talked about this over the past year. I mean, we have seen so many instances of people of color, black men specifically, being gunned down, murdered. And what I found myself wanting to do in that moment was connect my friends to their own emotional reaction to what was happening. Because I have this sense that the way we talk about race in America tends to focus explicitly on how racism impacts and influences the lives of people of color and black folks. But I really wanted my white friends to recognize that it impacts them too. And I tried to explore some of the ways in which they could begin to do some of the work that would maybe reveal to them the ways in which they've been racialized and potentially even harmed by the ways race and racism play out in their own lives.
I think this is important that you're addressing not just white people, but white men in particular, and men of your age, Generation X.
Yeah. Gen Xers were the first ones that were born into and raised within this sort of post-civil rights world. And what it meant was the ways in which we were educated often were through a benevolent lens that sought to, in many ways, obscure conversations around race, so that many of us became adults with very underdeveloped understandings of the ways in which race and racism operate.
Why? Was it because there was like this sense that we should be colorblind, that everything's fine, that it's not the way it used to be? I mean, why do you think that is?
A big part of it was aspirational. But then I think there was a colorblindness movement that does emerge and a multiculturalism movement that does emerge. And there's also this political swing that was happening in the 1970s. And I write about this as well. Like, unbeknownst to us as a generation, there was already a significant rollback happening that was playing out at the Supreme Court and playing out more explicitly in school busing and the suburbanization of a lot of, you know, the society we live in. So we have a lot of young friends of mine, my buddies. Their parents moved them to the suburbs. And many times our education, our lives became very resegregated, when in fact the intention was for us to be engaging with these conversations. We were not at all. I talk about in the book my own experience of being in an education environment and realizing how little race was discussed and how little racism was explored, such that I just felt often in class like I was alone and did not have in any way an experience that was reflective of my journey or my people's journey.
We need to talk about that time. You didn't just go to any school. You went to Sidwell Friends School in Washington, D.C. I mean, this is an elite private school. President's children have gone there. It's mostly white. Tell me more about what you realized about yourself through that experience.
With the time I was growing up and I was coming of age, I lived in D.C. in a part of the city called Shepherd Park, and a lot of the Black middle-class families were sending their children to independent schools, and Sidwell was one of those schools. And so when I arrived there, I actually had the benefit of having some friends from my neighborhood who were older than me who were in the school. But in my own class, there were a handful of us, and I do want to make sure that that's people are aware. It wasn't as if it was bereft of color, but it was the case that we were sprinkled around so much. I found myself often in classes where I was the only one. And it was that sort of like experience of being in a very privileged environment, and there was a very rigorous academic set of, you know, expectations built around that. And yet we didn't nevertheless engage with, at least in my experience, engage in any kind of deep and what I consider responsible way with the ways in which racism and racialization was happening. And that, I think, is a function of many ways of like the 80s and the time period itself. And before, I think, larger conversations around how structural and systemic racism operate, that wasn't a part of our narrative, our experience. So that we missed a lot of that stuff.
But you say something in the book, something to the effect of you thought that because you'd gone to a school with the children of powerful white people, that you were, in fact, one of them, which you, of course, weren't.
I'm going through my own journey of learning, and I'm writing to you about my journey of learning for the purposes of you doing your own reflection. What happens when a young Black person like myself, you end up in an environment where we don't talk about difference? In my mind, I start to believe that the world is going to treat me the same way I'm being treated by my white friends in this kind of very isolated environment. Yeah, you start to think like, this is all good. Like, we're all treated the same because in this bubble, that's how it's happening. Mm-hmm. But that's not how it plays out in the world. And in college, I begin to see a very different experience, in fact.
I want to ask you about something that comes up a lot in this book. You've hinted at it already. And that is that racism has, of course, harmed Black people for generations and generations. But in fact, it has also harmed white men and white people, and it has robbed their lives of fullness, and that they likely don't even know it.
Right.
Tell me what you mean by that. Right. What is the harm?
I try to give people examples such as like we move through parts of our lives and they're just things that we begin to avoid because we assume that they're inferior. We assume that a book written by a Black person is not going to be of the same quality that the book written by a white person is. We assume that art produced by Black people may not be of the same quality. We begin to make a lot of assumptions because we don't have engagement with that sort of thing. And there's a significant loss that's a result of that. Even as we talk about how we have DEI and there's the whole DEI landscape and the work that's happening around it, I find a lot of
diversity, equity, and inclusion. Right.
Yeah, diversity, equity, and inclusion. A lot of people engage with that with a lot of trepidation, uncertainty, fear, and even defensiveness. And what I invite is that actually what we're trying to do is unlock the potential for us to live with more joy, more fullness. Because if I think about some of my interactions with white men when I might meet them the first time, there's often like there's trepidation, there's an uncertainty, there's a wariness about engagement. And I feel like what we could actually have is a real relationship with one another, but you've in many ways been socialized to believe that I'm different. So the harm, I think, is broad in the sense that we miss out on a lot. We miss out on a lot of different people and experiences and engagements that we could otherwise have.
Was that something that was difficult for you to come to and understand that racism also hurts white people?
What I was always struck by was that in order to be a successful Black person in America, you must engage with white America. There is no way around that. That is not the same if you're a white person in America. You can arrive at and ascend to leadership level, CEO, whatever you might want to call it, and really have never actually engaged with people of color or Black people. And therefore, I see and encounter a lot of leaders right now who are looking and seeking the competency that they've never actually been challenged to have. And that is to be able to just navigate and negotiate difficult conversations at the heart of which might be race or identity or gender or ethnicity.
And so you're having these conversations with white men, especially more and more after the death of George Floyd. How does that leave you feeling? Like, are you energized, depleted, concerned, optimistic, all of the above?
I will say this. It's been really encouraging because there was a group of white men who decided to self-organize and begin to go on their own racial awakening journey, if you will. It was completely independent of me. And a couple of my friends, a couple of them were people I had never met but who had read the letter. And they actually began to meet every week and build a curriculum around that and then recruited other guys into this experience. to see people take it on and decide that this is that important that I'm going to spend my Monday night 10 weeks in a row with guys I don't know talking about this, I'm incredibly inspired by that. I also really appreciate and honor when people come to me and want to have a real conversation that they feel like if they try to engage in more public spaces, they will end up being in many ways canceled. I want people right. to feel like it's okay to start the conversation with me. Please understand that I'm going to check you if I feel like you might be approaching something with sort of a lack of empathy or a lack of awareness. I'm going to try to fill that gap in, but I'm not going to turn away from you in the conversation. So yeah, does it require energy on my part? Sure, but I think that's the whole point of us trying to work through this together. So to your point, it's inspiring. It's a little bit exhausting, but it's necessary. We got to have white men in these conversations. We cannot have a racial reckoning without it.
Yeah. You use the word empathy there.
Yeah.
In relation to the conversations that you want white men to have with you. It's interesting, though, because I'm also hearing you say empathy is required of you as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. This is a two-way street. I own the fact that I am both a man in this society. I'm a man who identifies as heterosexual, so I own an experience and privilege as well. And therefore, I need to demonstrate and model some of that empathy relative to these people who are in my life. Like these white men, I'm the ones I wrote the letter to, these are some of my closest friends in the world. We're not talking about some people I just kind of know in passing. These are my brothers too. And if I love you and I care about you, I'm upset and disappointed that maybe you only are now coming to this realization at 40 some years old, but you're here now and I'm grateful for you being here now. We got some real work we need to do and you need to be part of it because fundamentally you hold tremendous power and sway in this society.
Dax Devlin Ross is the author of the new book, Letters to My White Male Friends. Thank you so much for talking to us about it today. I appreciate it.
And thank you for having me on the show.
NPR's No Compromise podcast just won the Pulitzer Prize. We explore a breed of gun rights activism that's online, organized, and unwilling to budge. I'm Chris Haxel.
I'm Lisa Hagen. Check out No Compromise wherever you get your podcasts.
The Biden administration wants 70% of Americans at least partially vaccinated by the 4th of July, and public health experts say we're unlikely to get there. Still, the push continues. One of the president's initiatives is called Shots at the Shop to reach black-owned barbershops and salons. WAMU's Dominique Maria Bonessi visited a salon in Maryland.
Outside the Tres Shades Hair Studio in Capitol Heights, Maryland, a DJ greets customers as they arrive on a Monday afternoon. There's catered food and free giveaways like essential oils and shaving kits. Inside, owner Katrina Randolph has traded in her hairstylist for nurses and transformed the salon into a COVID vaccine clinic. Workers with a local health system check in patients like 54-year-old Calvin Goff and escort them to swiveling barber chairs.
Okay.
A nurse rubs an alcohol wipe on a small area of Goff's arm and gives him a quick jab. She then guides him to an observation area to wait 15 minutes.
If you move your arm along, just make sure you put some ice. If you get a fever, Tylenol or ibuprofen, okay? Do you grab a seat over here? You okay now?
Goff says uncertainty about the vaccine led him to wait a while to get it. But his desire to see his friends again convinced him to finally get vaccinated.
At the end of this month, I'll be hanging out with a much, 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 much older friend of mine. And I could not have that on my conscience if I was to leave and something bad to happen to her or her family.
Goff is one of about 25 pre-scheduled appointments today. Another 50 doses of either the two-dose Pfizer or the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccines are available for walk-ins. Bobby Monaghan and her 12-year-old daughter were across the street at the post office when they noticed the pop-up clinic. She's already vaccinated, but didn't have any luck scheduling shots for her kids at a local pharmacy.
I think it's easy for us to just walk in and get the vaccine done as opposed to having to make an appointment and wait. So, you know, we were able to get it done today, and I think that's just awesome.
If I could save a village, I definitely would.
Randolph's been in the business for more than 20 years and says she's excited to help her customers and others in the community get vaccinated. She often talks with her clients about health disparities.
A lot of them are probably hesitant about the vaccine because they have even experienced distrust in the healthcare system when it came to their loved ones.
Randolph says her ability to make people feel comfortable and her desire to help others led to her partnership with Stephen Thomas. He's the director of the Center for Health Equity at the University of Maryland.
So what better place to be to build trust than to go where people already have it?
Thomas founded the HARE program, which stands for Health Advocates in Reach and Research, in Pittsburgh around 2005. He later brought the program to the University of Maryland in 2010. Originally, the goal was to spread awareness for colorectal cancer screenings to a population of mostly Black and brown people. But now, Thomas says,
it took a pandemic to truly bring the Barbershop Health Network from the margins to the mainstream.
This month, Randolph and Thomas will help train 200 hairstylists from around the country on how to dispel COVID myths and host their own vaccination events. Randolph says her biggest piece of advice to her customers is,
if you're going to take this information and make decisions for your life with it, make sure you're going on CDC on a regular basis, making sure that you're talking to the healthcare professionals, that you're not just listening to hearsay.
All of this with the goal of getting to 70% of Americans with at least a dose of the vaccine by July 4th. For Here and Now, I'm Dominique Maria Benessi.
And we want to follow up on a story that made national headlines nearly 6 years ago. A police shooting in a Houston hospital that nearly killed a 26-year-old patient.
In developing news, a man from Mission is recovering tonight after being shot by an off-duty police officer in Houston. The family of 26-year-old Alan Pian says he is now conscious and breathing. Action 4's Nestor Mato.
Today, journalist Sarah Varney revisits this story to examine how a family is forever changed by a case like this. Sarah is a health policy correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's first talk about the Pian family. There's Harold Pian. He's a Haitian immigrant and internal medicine physician in Texas. His wife, Paloma, is an immigrant from Mexico, and their three sons are Christian, Alan, and Dominic. What did you learn about the parents' initial ideas when they immigrated here about American life?
So Harold Pian, he was born in Haiti to a quite wealthy family. His father went from being a judge in Haiti to getting a job working the elevator at Rockefeller Center in New York City. His wife joined him a few years later, and then eventually Harold and all of his brothers and sisters moved to New York. In Harold's view, racism did not exist. It wasn't a part of his childhood. For Paloma, she had grown up in Mexico near Veracruz and did not experience racism per se, she says. But both of them had this earnest belief in the American ideals of meritocracy, that if you come to the United States and you work hard, that there will be nothing in your way to succeed.
Your piece centers on the couple's son, Alan, and what happened to him 5 years ago. He's bipolar and would sometimes have delusions. During one hospital stay in Houston, his delusions escalated. Take us from there.
Yeah, so Alan had just transferred to a school in Houston, and he was starting to feel agitated. He had been hospitalized a number of years before for what they believed was a bipolar disorder, but he had never had an official diagnosis. So he started feeling agitated. He started having these delusions, and he knew enough to drive himself to the hospital in Houston. He was driving kind of out of control. He crashed his car when he got to the hospital parking lot. They did admit him. They never actually gave him a psychological evaluation. They never prescribed him any kind of antipsychotic medication. The next morning when Harold and Paloma arrived at the hospital, they wanted to get him some treatment. So they left the hospital for about a half an hour to go back to their hotel room and regroup. And during that time, Alan became delusional again, and he wandered into the hallway, and the nurses called a crisis code, and these two off-duty police officers from the Houston Police Department responded. They went into the room, closed the door behind them. There were no doctors, no nurses, no hospital staff with them except for these police officers. And the police officers said in their statements that Alan became hostile, that he was acting, quote, like a Tasmanian devil. They tased him. And when they say that when the tasing didn't work, one of the police officers took out his gun and shot Allen through the chest, narrowly missing his heart. This nearly killed him. His parents returned back to the hospital to find that Allen was in the ICU and that he had been shot. And they had a very difficult time over the next couple of days getting even answers as to what had happened.
This was huge news when it happened. It made national headlines. Allen faced charges after the shooting. How and why did this happen?
He did face charges. I mean, they charged him everything from reckless driving, coming into the parking lot, to assaulting a police officer. Here we are 6 years later. He is still involved in a lawsuit against the hospital. And the hospital continues to maintain that if an episode like this happened again, they would do the exact same thing. So this is, of course, Allen's and the whole family's great frustration, is that it just sort of stunned them and forced them to confront what they believed was the racist motivation behind the shooting itself and just the treatment of the family. You know, as you mentioned, Harold himself is a physician. Two of the three brothers, Dominic and Christian, are either in medical school or have just graduated from medical school. They have an uncle who's a prominent pulmonologist, also in the McAllen area. So these are people who are used to being respected in hospitals. And they found themselves just thrown into this alternate reality in which nobody could give them a straight answer and nobody could help them understand what had happened in that room.
This is where you pick up the story, because you write that the shot fired into Allen's chest would extinguish the Payans family's belief that diligent high achievers could outwit the racism that shadows the American promise. Equality would not be a choice left up to the trio of ambitious boys. They've gone on from this point to somewhat reluctant activists. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. Obviously, Paloma and Harold individually have their own notions of what it meant to be here in the United States and to be putting their roots down here. And each of the boys, though, each of the men, the young men, had their own reactions to this. For Christian, who was the oldest Payan son, his reaction was immediate, that we should not be quiet about this, that we should use what happened to Allen to advocate for change in the healthcare system. Allen was much more reluctant about this. He struggles with mental illness, but he was showing up going on Dr. Oz or having to go do another speech at another medical school. And while he wants to do those things, he also wants to sometimes just retreat inside himself, you know, live his life away from the responsibility that he survived. So Allen feels that he has this burden because he survived and so many other Black men have not survived their encounters with police, that he has to, in a sense, kind of make good on this survival. And Christian talks about how he doesn't want Allen to feel like a prop. He doesn't want other people to think he's using Allen as a prop. You know, there's no doubt that he is earnest and wants to make these changes in the healthcare system and more broadly in our society. But he's conflicted about what he should do with Allen's story since it didn't actually happen to him per se.
And he's still battling that.
Still to this day, he, you know, one of the things I write about in the piece is a few months after the shooting, Allen was back in McAllen, Texas, and Christian called the whole family up to New York City for this Rise Up October march against police brutality. Really the first time that the family had come together and very publicly joined in with all of these other families that have been touched by police brutality. And each of them really had their own experience with it. You know, for Christian, he was really clear that he wanted to be there. But then when he heard some of the, I described this in the piece, that there's a chant breaks out of F the police. And Christian feels that, you know, this isn't the tone we should be setting. So he wades into the crowd and he gets into this argument with a white family that's there whose child had actually been shot in the head by the police. And he's begging them to please, you know, let's change the chant. And Christian, in his own mind, is thinking at the time, you know, this was 2015, he was applying to orthopedic residency programs, and only 1.5% of orthopedic surgeons are Black. And he, you know, talked to me about how he was nervous that everything is Googleable, if I can say that word correctly. And he was worried about this somehow impacting his career, but at the same time felt that this was unnegotiable, that he had to, in fact, move forward with this.
How is Allen doing?
Allen is doing well. Allen has just moved from New York City down to McAllen, Texas, and he is working at his parents' clinic. And I think he's still interested, you know, once COVID passes and hopefully once this lawsuit is settled, that he'll be able to be out and more public about what's happened to him and what he wants in the healthcare system.
You know, the reasons that you've laid out so clear that this story is important to you to share now is because it touches on all of these interconnected issues that we've been reckoning with in the last year since the murder of George Floyd, policing disparities in medical care, the way in which our societies address mental health emergencies. How are we to take stock of all of this with this particular story?
Yeah, I think it's very easy to become inured to the tragedy that so many families have experienced in the United States because of all of these things. And I think it's really important to understand that under each of these stories is not just the person that it's happened to, but to also, you know, everyone in the family, in the community. You know, this is something where it really truly does ripple out. And I think it's so important to go deep with each one of these stories to really understand what the total effect has been of this institutional racism, of the healthcare system, how we treat people with mental illness. You know, that it's not going to be enough for us just to kind of talk in platitudes or in policy talk, that we really have to get down to the sort of each individual family story and the emotion and the trajectory that this violence has sent into their lives.
Sarah Varney is a health policy correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and we'll link you to her story at hereandnow.org. Sarah, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
As we navigate this next chapter of the pandemic, many Americans are reevaluating their lives at work. And that is why our next guest says it may be time to rethink the idea of saving money to retire early and instead save up for a new career. Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And look, the reason we're talking about this in the first place is because the labor force in the United States is really, it's something of an inflection point as we emerge from this pandemic. What are you seeing out there?
So right now, there are 7.6 million fewer jobs than we had before the pandemic, right? But at the same time, job openings have reached a near two-decade high. And so what I think is happening is there is a lot of flux in the labor market. Some of this is going to be shifting and changing and kind of getting back to normal as the summer months end and people's kids go back to school and they get their daycare issues and childcare issues worked out. So I think some of that is really going to come to bear in the marketplace. But also, there's something fascinating going on in that over the last year and a half, people have really been reconsidering what they want their work life to be. And this is up and down the income stream. It really is fascinating. And I've never seen anything like this in the labor market in years. We are really seeing change right now.
And that is why you put a spin on something known as the FIRE movement. So instead of saving money to retire early, you say people might consider saving money so that they have the flexibility to make a change or to rethink their careers. Tell me more what you have in mind.
Well, I have something called FINE, which one of my friends said it sounds kind of weak, but I think it's great.
Sounds fine to me.
It's just fine. It's fine. And it stands for Financial Independence New Endeavor. And this is what I think is kind of interesting. Can I create enough independence from the churn of having to be at the same job in the same sector every single day and week and year and do something different for myself so I'm independent enough from that churn to be able to do something new? This is a really important concept because for so many years, it's been very difficult for people to get out of that churn. But finally, we are seeing the biggest shift in power between workers and bosses and their companies that we have seen since the 1990s, that the power dynamic is now moving into the worker camp. And that might give some people opportunities that they had not yet considered.
So if workers are in the driver's seat and they're considering this, how would they save with a fine mindset. And what does that really look like when the economy, yeah, it's recovering, but it's actually still pretty unsettled. There's inflation happening. The cost of housing is sky high. Gas prices are way up.
Well, I think that what I can take from this is that, of course, over the last year, there have been so many people who've really lost ground in the pandemic. But there are also people who have gained ground financially. And the savings rate almost at every tier has skyrocketed. And this may be your opportunity to take a deep breath and to say to yourself, what do I want to do next? Where are the opportunities? And how can I actually create a new endeavor for myself or for my family that makes more sense? Now, it's not for everyone. I know that. There are a lot of people who don't have these choices. But I have been very surprised and frankly encouraged by hearing from people, even the lower wage workers, who are saying, you know what I learned during this pandemic? I need to be closer to my family. And so I now need to find a career, a job, a place where I can hang my hat, where I can continue that. And so you see these stories playing out sector after sector. It's really interesting.
And so that flexibility might mean that you could take a job that doesn't pay as well, or maybe you could take some time off to figure out what you really want to do. But how do you know when you have enough of a cushion or financial independence so that you can take that leap?
Well, I think that I'm such a numbers nerd, so I'm going to go back to user calculators, which I know people have a hard time thinking about. But, you know, there are so many easy to use places on the web where you can look at, hey, what is it that I really think I can earn somewhere else? This is a great moment to do this. Again, you know, we have found through lots of surveys that about a quarter of employees are planning to look for a different job this year. What is it in that next job that you want? What is most important to you? And like flexibility could be important, but maybe you've been working in a restaurant for years. You like that restaurant, but you never had a retirement plan. And maybe this is the moment where you say, I'd really like to work someplace where I have regular hours and that I actually have a way to save for retirement with maybe a little help from the employer. So there are a lot of things that are out there that are giving people pause and reconsidering what their options are. And what a great time to do it when the workers, again, have more power than they've had in a few decades.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money, will link you to her latest post about the FINE movement. Jill, sounds like a good idea to me. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dell.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.